Hello, welcome to Dead Archives. The tape you're about to hear is Rapper's Delight. This tape is designed to bring to you the essence of the oral tradition of the Northern California rock culture through conversations and recorded interviews from the 60s and early 70s. The peculiar things about the following tape is that many of the people you will hear are now dead. So it's of an importance that these be recorded and so stored for future reference. The following is an interview with Jerry Garcia, recorded live. It's probably the most significant historical interview in that it goes into great detail about his basic life philosophy. Well, Garcia is asked how he communicated with his mother, and this interview was done shortly after her tragic death in an automobile accident.
But I don't feel that really our relationship, I don't feel as though it's gone forever. I feel as though more like that was underlying throughout, you know what I mean? That she always respected what I did and liked the fact that I was a musician and liked what I was doing and so forth. And she never judged me even through things like involvement with drugs and stuff like that. You know, she was always pretty good. And so I don't feel really too badly about it, but it's a shock, you know, like those things, like things like that always are. And but on another level, of course, it's interesting how once your parents are gone, you know,
like the foundation,
they're gone. You know, that's
what you plug into.
Yeah, it's very it's strange. On some levels, it's liberating. On other levels, it's very sad. You know?
Yeah, Jerry. One thing I have to make this comment. It may sound like a departure from where we are, but. I think people would expect Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, who does not appear on television, they would expect, on meeting you this close, a much more sort of, I don't know, far out, flamboyant, you know, heavy dude type, swinger. I don't know, I think we have stereotypes of musicians and stereotypes of the, certainly the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, that there's a whole mystique about the Dead and about Jerry Garcia, and you're very real, very believable, very normal, dare I say. Am I blowing your whole image?
No, no, I don't think so.
Are you conscious of that, a kind of disparity between who you really are and what people expect of you?
Well, sure, because it works both ways, too. I mean, on some levels, the media relation to the reality is... It's always wrong, I believe. You know, I believe it never is very accurate because of just everything. You know, language itself is one heavy bias, you know. So it's, but I've been, described both ways, you know, more radically than I am, more conservatively than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a discrepancy on either level, you know what I mean? I don't really feel that. I don't relate to that, for one thing. I sort of taught myself that early, not to believe that that's who I am, you know. That's not me.
Yeah.
And so I don't relate to it. And luckily, the kind of fame that I'm involved in, whatever such as it is low enough of a profile so that I'm not constantly being reminded of it. You know, I don't
people don't run up for autographs.
Right.
And
no, forth, you know. No, it's much cooler than that.
And yet people talk about, and maybe there's a difference between you when you are on stage performing, communicating musically, and you sitting here, as you said, using words.
Right.
There, because people talk about the saint-like quality. I don't mean it in a negative way, but there is an aura about you, whether you're aware of it or whether people put it there. And it's like the thing you were saying before, I thought very meaningfully. I said to you how my churches are empty. I need this, Gracie, to reach young people.
Right.
You don't. You can go to Winterland and fill the place up with tens of thousands of young people. And you said, yeah, and I feel responsible.
Yeah.
I am concerned about that. I think it's that kind of a leadership, not an egomania, but a concern. hey, here I am because of my talent, because of timing, because
luck,
of any
whatever,
number,
yeah, right.
And here I am, right. And what am I, you know, I know that you put words down and say, well, words are often lies because you can never communicate the whole feeling, the whole meaning, and music does it better. You've said that many times,
yeah.
Because it's more, it's freer, it's more open, and it allows for people to come in at different levels,
right.
With different backgrounds. And,
right.
So, but you are communicating something.
I try to make an effort to, certainly. You know.
What is it? Can you describe that or talk about that?
It's difficult since the things that concern me tend to be not verbal in nature. You know, they tend to be experiential. The fact is that most of my life has to do with certain kinds of experience that have been repeated, you know, like many times, the high energy experience of playing for a large body of people and for the purpose of reaching some level, you know. And so that energy and that thing is something that I know about, but I can't say what it is. So what I talk about, if I can talk about things, I try to make it so that what the content of what I'm saying is, you know, reflects something that I know on that level.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say it, so I have to not say it. You know, I have to talk around it or something. You know.
Your music does that too, definitely.
Right.
I sort of throw out little snatches, little
right.
phrase, thought things. There isn't a whole neat package ever.
No,
just
there isn't.
Bother you.
Right.
Wait a minute.
Right.
You're mean. I have to think. I have to.
Yeah, I think. I personally feel it. That people like that. I mean, I know I do. You know, it's on some levels it's all very simple. On other levels, it's difficult to talk about.
Yeah, you're very conscious of. I think the Grateful Dead probably have done more. Certainly, they're one of the most generous major groups in the country. They've done more free concerts and spontaneous gigs and fundraising things and stuff. But you're very much aware of this continuous. Sort of feed and be fed, the interaction between you and the audience, which
right.
you say can't be captured, obviously, in a record or even in a film. You're doing a film now,
right. Right.
What, on the last five shows
right.
at the Winterland, and
right.
To see, I mean, maybe some experience can be communicated in film, as it can in television.
That's why we tried it. You know,
yeah.
Can it happen? You know, maybe it can, and maybe it can. You know.
Yeah. it might work. Now, it's not working too well on TV, the midnight specials and so forth, even with all their cameras, you can't...
Well, I think it reduces it too much, you know, that particular kind of experience, I think it just reduces it, makes it too small, you know. That's one level of it. But
the hard thing is that you don't get any kind of feedback then, because you're not into fame and money.
No, but I'm into a more direct kind of feedback. I like to be in a situation where I can really talk to the people who like our music, you know, and we have a pretty good two-way flow that they write to us pretty freely, and by and large, they're pretty articulate. They know what we're doing,
yeah.
And we recognize them by the way they speak to us, you know what I mean? So we know that what they're talking about is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so that we know, we're aware of that reciprocal thing.
That's amazing. I know you send out, you have a mailing list of 35,000 or something, and you send out a preview, what are they called, sampler,
right.
You know,
right.
audition copies of the
right.
albums before they,
right.
of the records.
And they send stuff to us, too. You know, they talk to us and tell us about what it's
that's
like.
That's a big part of you, that collaborative effort, because I know in the beginning your music was eclectic. You started with the jug band kind of bluegrass sound,
right.
banjo, guitar, and got into the whole thing, blues and jazz, which is a great thing, and you kind of explored all those ramifications, and now you're into a whole new form for creating.
Right.
You do listen to all, at all different levels.
Right, well, it's because it's more interesting from the standpoint of a person who's involved in lots of different kinds of energy, that's what's interesting to me, and on a certain level, that is what I do also. I deal with lots of different kinds of energy, and I feel that I'm essentially someone who works into things, you know, rather than I'm not an artist in the solo or in the independent artist in the garret mold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that sort of person.
Follow me again.
Right. I'm, you know, part of dynamic situations, and that's where I like it, and that's where I feel I function best. And the Grateful Dead is a collection of people, or all people who've come to that idea, you know, all through various different ways, and it works, you know, that's that's really all we have to say about what we do. You know, if you want to see it work, if you want to see a situation work that doesn't have any leader, that doesn't have any plan, or doesn't and is utterly formless, really, from moment to moment, then, you know, you don't have to guess about whether something like that will work.
Yeah.
We have it, and it's working.
Yeah.
And, you know,
how can you do that without bumping egos?
Well, we bump egos. But I think, but everybody has learned that the best things happen when everybody agrees and feels that that's the right thing to do, rather than one person has an idea and everybody else feels a little funny about it. So we go on that level of, if somebody doesn't like it, we don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned to trust each other after a long enough time of fiddling around with this idea. We've learned to trust each other to the point of saying, well, it's, you know, if a person doesn't like it, it's no good.
Yeah.
And that idea comes from the idea, basically, that no idea really makes it if you can't include everybody in it. If you can't bring everybody.
Oh, that sounds like marriage.
A good marriage or a good family.
Well, I think it's just a good way for people to work together.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
And of course, it depends on what they're doing. I think you'd probably run into trouble if you were trying to build a bridge, you know. You know, you can't improvise on that level too well, but I believe that if you had people that were all really skilled at that particular world, that they could do it. Because on another level, I mean, on the mathematics level, architecturally, that's musically, that's what the Grateful Dead does, is we're creating architectures, you know,
mm-hmm.
architectural models, if you will, of kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
And they work, and each person adds their own personality to the whole thing, and it works, you know, somehow.
Yeah.
And I think that everything could be that way, really.
Where do you go to prime the pump? Where do you go to get your spiritual energy?
Enthusiasm that you were almost at, but then enthusiasm. I think, I mean, the thing of feeling good about it is like really, as far as I'm concerned, that's the gold in the situation. That's the payoff, if there is one, on the level of why am I involved. I'm involved because I like it and because it feels good. And the enthusiasm of feeling good about something, you know, I think that's the most important thing about it is, you know,
yeah.
on a personal level, like what do I get out of it?
Uh-huh.
That's what I get out of it. And by that, I just mean that I think that it's a good thing to have some one thing that you can work on a more or less a daily basis and be able to see improvement in your own terms that is a result only of your own energy being put into the thing, you know what I mean? It's the kind of thing, anything that you decided to do, if you did it every day and it was something that you could notice yourself improving, even if it was whatever it was,
yeah.
you know, cat's cradles, you know. You know, crossword puzzles,
prayer,
right?
They're all forms.
Sure, they're all forms, and they're all. And I think that the things that keep opening in front of you, that the more you do them, the better you get at them. You know, that idea, I think, is really a nice idea to have in your life. It keeps you centered to something. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to be worried about how you're being judged in some absolute sense, but you can judge your own progress on a day-to-day basis. And when you're doing something like that, you know when you're off, and you know when you're on.
You're on.
Pigpen's next.
I was a bus driver in San Francisco. That was a couple of years ago. But only man named Dave got busted and everything. There was, and the thing with the chateau was there was some chick named Kathy who used to always hang around there. And the standard answering procedure of the telephone at the chateau was you pick up the phone and say, chain three, Kathy ain't here. Click.
What's chain three?
There was three threes in a row in that phone number.
Oh, I see. 333-3333 or something like that.
Oh, there were three threes in a row. I don't remember the number, but there were three threes in a row.
So Pigpen was very young at the time. The time the Grateful Dead started. Phil and Jerry knew each other. Indirectly. And the Chateau crowd were hanging around up in Palo Alto above what is now the Stanford Linear Accelerator. It was an old house run by an older guy that liked to play poker named Frank Serotoni. He gave cheap room and board to a lot of people that came in and out of that scene. Pigpen and Jerry lived there for a while.
Jerry played the Winter Star in Hunter and Kissing. Hunter lived there. Jerry lived there, Danny lived there. Who else lived there? Willie LeGate lived there. Just a bunch of the people that we know, you know, used to live there. And I used to just sort of...
Well, I never told you a story about, say, he used to come in on Saturday and say, I'm here, where's the drinks? And the cops came looking for her, and she got up in a tree and pretended she was an owl, and the cops didn't find her.
Give me a hint about it now. Is somebody here?
Yeah,
Mother Mary.
Yeah.
Blonde chicken, big tits.
I don't know.
Yeah, she used to be around a lot. And she'd come around. We had parties over at East Palo Alto all the time, mm-hmm. over at Pogo's place and all that. And she'd be around.
Phil got into some mysterious trouble one time down there, and he came and asked me about what he should do. Some chick, I don't know, it was Donna?
Donna Dowser.
Well, it was some chick that was like underage, like she was sick.
Yes, that was Donna Dowser.
And her dad owned an ice cream store, or a soda fountain, or a drive-in. And Phil used to take her there or something like that.
And her father said,
father said, who's that? And it was some weird thing, but anyway, the next day, Phil had the police after him, and he came to my house, and now, this is very few people know this, but he came to my house on the land, like on the run, you know. There was a warrant out for him, you know.
Get off that cord there, Calhoun.
Calhoun, you want to shock your shoes?
No, he's not going to shock himself. He's just going to rip the cord out the back of this. No, I made it, that was during the Boar's Head days.
Rod Albin and the Boar's Head,
yeah,
right? In San Mateo.
Right.
Okay.
With George the Beast.
George the Beast, what was his last name?
Howell.
H-O-W-E-L-L.
I don't know how to spell it. Just George Howell.
Okay, well, I think George Howell was later responsible for getting together the Charlatans, right? Wasn't he the same George that lived with Janice over on Page Street? Not 1090 Page, but another place on Page Street.
No, that was, George Hunter.
George Hunter.
Right.
Well, he got into the show. It's George Hunter. Was actually.
Well, he was one of the instigating members of the whole group.
But he actually couldn't play a note. They told me.
George Hunter?
Originally.
Well, he could play.
Could he?
Yeah, it wasn't, no, but George Howell, this was a long time ago.
George Howell and Rod Albin.
This was when
at the Boar's Head.
John Winter.
Yeah.
Me and him have the same birthday. September 8th.
1940 what?
I'm 45 and he's 42, I think.
Well, he's older than me.
Yeah, he's a couple, 3 years older than me.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, John the Cool.
John the Cool, yeah, but you see, he was like, when Phil and I first met, he was at Primrose Bookshop. He let us steal books out of there, right? And he was only 17 and we were 19 and we were big shit. You know, he was a little punk, you know. It was really weird.
You know, you're sure you're not talking about Mike, his little brother.
No, Mike Winter I met later, after the... During the Warlocks days, I met Mike Winter.
Right, at the in-room.
At the in-room and all that shit. No. This was much earlier. John Winter used to sell books. He used to be a clerk. He used to have a big black Pontiac or something like that. Like a six-wheeler. And he was there, he sold it to Phil for $50. And it never ran. And, it was really an elaborate trip. This was 59-60. Now, it's weird that we never met before that, you know, because... Oh, I guess it's because I was some kind of a snob and I never wanted to go down there. I went down to a party at Perry Lane at Homer Lane.
Oh, yeah.
Homer Lane was really where the action was. But Perry Lane is where the older guys lived.
Like, right, what was the guy's name who had the goatee and the kind of a satanic...
Roy Siebert.
No, not Roy. I'm not talking about Roy. Huh?
Paige Browning.
No, not Paige. I know all them guys.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about another guy who used to live next door, a couple of doors up. On Perry Lane from Kesey when he was living there.
Did you ever go with her to visit?
To Kesey's? Yeah, that was when Royal Seagrin was living in the barn.
Right. Yeah.
Well, not the barn, the garage, I mean.
Yeah.
No, in front, right next door. Mm-hmm. There was a guy up the street whose name I can't remember, but he looked like a kind of a satanic looking cat. And he was older and he had like a goatee and it was sort of, he had a little gray in it. And he was like a professional student at Stanford or something.
Yeah. That's where they all lived, up at Homer Lane.
Really? Yeah, Perry Lane was really fun. It was a good trip. And Roy Seaborn used to make up some kind of wine. He'd take some kind of white wine and put grape juice in it. It wasn't shaken ups like WPLJ or anything.
No.
It was some other kind of stuff that he used to concoct.
Yeah.
And it was pretty weird. Me and the Lockers just got there. Bring a guitar. Just sit around. You know, Kesey's house a couple times was like just right. You didn't even have to go across the street. You just...
That's the first time in my life I ever saw... Yeah, it was in the same lot almost, you know. That's the first time I ever saw anybody laid out on marijuana and booze. I mean, passed out
Who's that?
Some chick. I don't know. Hmm? I went up to, Phil took me up to a party up there one night, you know. Hmm. And they kept saying, well, who lives here? Well, some guy's writing a book. I said, oh, what's the name of his book? And they said something about a cuckoo. And I laughed. Yeah.
Yeah. You know. It was during that time, you know, that I met Keithy and, you know, yeah. All that. And Tom, he's married to Arne Galvin's sister.
I don't think I need that information. Anyway, it's on the tape video.
Anyway, first time I went to Keezy's house, I don't think Tom and Sue were married yet. And they were just sort of off and on. And Sue is a fox. And she was dancing, everybody drinking wine and dancing and carrying on. There was Sue.
What do you want?
Oh, I don't know if she was drunk or we just danced, you know. Everybody, Keezy was there, man, Roy was there, and me and Novakovich, and who knows who else. Paul Mittig, I think, was hanging out. Yeah, all the old school guys. And, I just had a flash because she looked really good when she was dancing. And then, Tom and Sue and Arne lived over on Manalco in Malabar, just a few blocks from Troy Wagner. You know Troy?
Yeah, I sure know Troy.
Just a little ways from there.
I never went to his house, but I know he ran Dan Martin's for a while.
I worked in a band with him.
Troy?
Yeah.
What band?
Zodiacs.
You had a band called Zodiacs? That's a little known fact. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, Troy was like lead.
This was a couple years before the Warlocks, though.
Yeah. It was when I was like 17. You know, 16, 17.
You were doing singles in coffee houses mostly, right?
In the Zodiacs, we were playing beer drinking Stanford fraternity parties.
Oh, yeah?
And Troy played like lead guitar. His old lady, Sherry, played rhythm guitar. Jerry would occasionally play bass.
Garcia?
Yeah.
Really? Like string bass, stand-up bass?
Electric bass.
Electric bass, is that right?
And, Ron Ogborn would play bass occasionally. Or either drums, he doubled on bass and drums. And I'd sing and play harmonica.
Now, this was before?
Before, way before the Warlocks.
Oh, I know that, but this was before offstage?
Before the offstage.
Yeah, and the tangent.
Yeah.
Before that, a year before.
Like, sure, because that was like
19. If you were 17, what year was that?
I don't know. Give me a slide rule.
You were born in 1945.
Five.
So it's 62.
During that whole offstage tangent period, it was sort of an amorphous trip because we were playing during the Chateau period.
Yeah, it was all the same thing.
During the Chateau period, right. And the Zodiacs. You know, we were playing then, and then after that, after the Zodiacs, we started into the Jug Band.
Mother McCree's.
Right.
Uptown. Now, what was the Asphalt Jungle Boys?
The Asphalt Jungle
Boys. There was something about Asphalt Jungle something, rather, that was a band that you were in, I think.
It was an offshoot of all of our friends, you know.
Matthews and Marmaduke and all those kids.
Right, just a bunch of guys.
Yeah. Okay.
As far as I know. And, so anyhow, we used to play gigs like Stanford fraternity parties, right? Yeah. They'd rent a place like, up at Searsville Lake. They'd rent the men's dressing room. it was just a big,
huge
stone room, you know, with benches on the sides, you know, and all showers and
pissers. Yeah, I know what Searsville Lake is.
And, so me and Troy and Sherry and Ogborn and, maybe Jerry or, what was that guy's name? It was another guy who played bass occasionally. It was sort of like mostly me and Troy and Sherry. And
did Dana Morgan play in those days?
No. And he started after we started practicing at his store. But that was after the Warlock. I mean, after the Zodiacs. And so it was mostly me, Troy, and Sherry. And Ogborn either played bass and drums, and there was this other guy who would play bass sometimes, and occasionally Jerry played bass.
Would Jerry play guitar then in those days?
Not with the Zodiacs. He played bass occasionally.
Was he playing the guitar at the time, though?
Oh, he'd been playing guitar, you know, years before that.
This is before he met Sarah, though, right?
Oh, yeah, years before that.
Okay, 62.
And so, we got these guys, these three black guys. This guy, Don D. Great. Yeah. That was his last name, D. Great.
Don the Great.
D. Great.
Yeah.
Anyway, and he had a couple of cats with him. And we'd play for house parties and stuff, and they'd sing and do like little like coaster kind of trips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was the lead singer.
R&B.
Yeah. And then decided to change the name to Dr. Don and the Interns. And so, you know, we were working with them off and on for a while. We used to play we played a setup club though, by Playland, and we played mostly house parties, you know, college house parties.
Well, a setup club by Playland, that wouldn't have been the,
It was an upstairs place.
Not the Family Dog.
No. But it was an upstairs place. It was a little south of the Family Dog. So we did that, and we backed up Don and everything. They do coasters, routines, and...
Robert's on the Beach.
Roberts?
Roberts on the Beach is the name of the place.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't remember the name.
I think it's Roberts on the Beach.
But it's an upstairs setup club.
Well, when did you first go up to the Heat Estuary?
Well, what sort of started out was when the Grateful Dead happened. You know, sort of got together, and we decided it was going to be the Grateful Dead.
That was later. That was 65. Late 65.
That was later.
Early 66.
So me and Bill had a house on, I think, Pope Street in Menlo Park.
Kreutzmann.
Yeah, and
he had an apartment on the freeway.
Yeah, but this was a little bit later.
Later than that.
Yeah, the apartment on the freeway was when we were playing at the In Room.
Right.
Okay, then he got a house.
Yeah.
And then we decided, well, you know, what the fuck? Let's move to L.A. So we went to L.A. And I moved out of my parents' house, and
we had the acid test out in L.A.
Yeah, it was when we got hung up with the acid test and started, you know, moving around and doing stuff instead of being like stationary and non-geographically productive.
Yeah.
And so me and Bill made a couple of runs between LA and the Bay Area, you know, to bring his stuff down. We all got a mattress and everything. We moved into the place in LA, started trying to promote our own dances and that kind of stuff. Which worked okay, except the cops ordered us to take down the posters off the telephone poles we nailed them to.
Oh, well, this was Danny and Rock kind of thing?
Yeah, right during that period.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was later, yeah.
That was the formative part of the Danny and Rock scene.
Okay.
And, you know, what happened from there, you know.
Well, see, I knew Danny and Rock at San Francisco State, and, many times when I came in there with pictures of the Warlocks, but Danny and Rock would be sitting around looking at them. Didn't even know you guys. So like that whole thing, see, that's not what the book's about. Right, at this point, I'm writing the book in two halves. I'm going to write the 64 to 66 scene after I get the 60 to 63 scene straightened out, because the really formative period, the whereabouts of everybody. Okay. Bert Chirito's Midnight Special, right. That was an evening.
That was the one. Alright, and me and Jerry, I played harmonica and Jerry played guitar.
Is that the one that Phil did the engineering on for?
I don't know if he did it or not.
Well, here's Phil's story. He came down there, he saw Jerry play, and he immediately went out. He had Tom Conn standing with him. And then I went out to the guitar, to the car, and Tom got out this big old, I think he still has it, that big tape recorder that he's got, you know. And they recorded Jerry right then and there. And they took the tapes over to Gert, and Gert dug him. And next week, Jerry was on the show. And then a week after that, you and Jerry, I think, so it all went down.
Yeah, because Jerry wanted me to play harp, you know.
Right.
You know, I just showed up, and let's play a little stuff.
Yeah. Well, those tapes would be perfect.